Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
I couldn't face the fact that that was the last I would ever see of him. You can't just disappear. That doesn't happen. He was having a breakdown. We had a flat with a second bedroom, joint income.
He met my nieces.
We'd have Friday night dinner at my mum's.
We used to go to Scotland every year.
Crete, Israel, Thailand, Vietnam.
Surprise break in Venice.
First summer, we went to Glastonbury.
Felt like we were in love.
Seemed to have similar outlooks in life.
Making love.
Quite inseparable.
We got chatting that night and we hit it off.
I certainly remember him arriving.
We're back at the beginning. The men in our story are just arriving on the scene. They're a few weeks away from romance. I want to look at everything that's happened in an entirely different light. These love stories have ended in heartbreak and worse. But how did they even start in the first place? What brought these men into the women's lives? Nothing in this story happened by accident. It was all planned. And how did it work? Well, the answers lie in a document. It's from 1995, and it's called the Special Demonstration Squad Tradecraft Manual. I've got Telegraph crime correspondent Martin Evans in the studio with me. He's been covering this story too. So, Martin, you're going to read some extracts from the Tradecraft Manual for us.
Yeah.
Could you just start with this paragraph here?
At first, it may seem a daunting prospect to enter the world of the wearies. While new recruits will have been carefully scrutinised prior to arrival on the squad, nothing can prepare them for the reality of SDS work.
These are the top secret instructions written for undercover police officers in the Special Demonstration Squad, or SDS. And it begins with a warning. Be prepared. What they're about to embark on is a daring mission. They'll be infiltrating left-wing political groups and living among them for 4 years.
The stresses and strains of living a lie during both your working and personal time and the unremitting nature of that pressure throughout the posting creates a wholly unique lifestyle, both for operatives and dependents alike.
The manual's a hefty document. It's over 140 pages long, and it's typed out on a word processor, then held together in a ring binder. It's a sort of best practice guide for new SDS recruits. And it's divided into chapters, like preparation, launch, living a normal life, and withdrawal. It contains everything from helpful tips and tactics to common pitfalls. And there's even some inside jokes.
The crusty lifestyle, in particular, is really unpleasant. You'll be expected to eat food you wouldn't put in your own bin, drink tea from cups which appear to have grown their own beards, and sit on furniture which is alive. The squatters are notorious for taking people for all they can get, and if you appear to be prepared to help them in a move or to drive them somewhere, they will use you until you drop. Worst of all, they smell disgusting in the summer months.
It's quite chilling when you read it with all the knowledge we now have. Knowing how deeply this work affected the lives of the women we've been following, and many others. There are pages and pages of notes. Some of it's quite procedural, but it's still so compelling. And it's all divided into clear sections, like this one on page 27. Sexual Liaisons, Part 5.6.3.
While you may try to avoid any sexual encounter, there may come a time when your lack of interest may become suspicious.
The next part's redacted, but then it comes back in with a line that jumps out.
Options are fraught with difficulty and you must make your own mind up how to proceed. If you have no other option but to become involved with a weary, you should try to have fleeting, disastrous relationships. One cannot be involved with a weary in a relationship for any period of time without risking serious consequences.
I'm Cara McGugan, and this is Bed of Lies, Episode 5, Tradecraft. So now we know the truth. The men in our story, Flash Mark, Jim the Vegan, Birkenhead Mark, Carla the Italian, and Andy Van, they're police officers, and they work for the Met, or more specifically, two secretive units within the London force that spy on political groups, the SDS and the National Public Order Intelligence Unit, or NPOIU. In this episode, we're going to look at things from the other side. I'm going to take you into the world of undercover policing. It's highly discreet, and even now, there's still so much we don't know. But here goes. The story begins in 1968. The world's divided by the Cold War. In the West, a wave of protests is challenging the status quo. There's student riots in Paris and civil rights marches in Washington. But things really come to a head over the Vietnam War. In London, more than 10,000 people head to the US Embassy at Grosvenor Square, and things turn violent.
There was a concern amongst politicians that this sort of insurrection would get out of control and that we would have some sort of anarchic society.
That's David Tucker. He's head of crime at the College of Policing, which trains police and sets standards. The people in charge want to nip the discontent in the bud. And the best tool at their disposal? Well, that's Special Branch, the arm of the British police that deals in matters of national security. Amid fears London could become a hub of revolution, Special Branch detective Conrad Dixon says to his superiors,
"Give me 20 men, £500,000 and a free hand, and then he will make the problem go away."
Conor Woodman's a researcher who spent a lot of time looking into the British police. Legend has it that this is the moment the SDS came into being.
And his proposal was basically to develop a specialist police unit gathering information on who is involved and what their activities are. It was aimed at in some way combating the effectiveness of these organisations and keeping tabs on them and making sure that they don't get out of hand.
It's not long before the SDS is infiltrating a whole range of political groups, like the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Women's Peace Camp at Greenham Common, and the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. The focus is on left-wing groups because the big battle of the day is against communism. As the decades pass, the SDS expands its reach.
By the 80s, they were infiltrating animal rights organisations, the Animal Liberation Front.
By the 90s, the Cold War's over and communism's washed up. But left-wing activism finds a new focus.
Environmental movements were caught up. Anarchist movements, auto-globalisation movements, black justice campaigns.
Then in 1999, the Met uses everything the SDS has learnt to create another unit, the NPOIU. Its brief is to monitor people across the whole country. Organisations it believes are caught up in some sort of criminality, and officers are meant to gather intelligence so they can disrupt plans. For the next decade, the two squads work simultaneously. But what do they actually do? How do they monitor all these different groups? Well, I think we know the answer to that. With undercover cops. So that brings us back to the document I'm holding, the Tradecraft Manual. It was finally made public in 2018, after years of Freedom of Information requests to the Met Police from journalists and campaigners. Even now, a lot of it's heavily redacted, There are whole pages blacked out. That's because it contains sensitive material, identifying details and tactics the police could still be using today. After all, the Met still has undercover cops in the field. But despite the gaps, it tells a fascinating story. And it's written by someone who might be familiar.
My wearies knew me only as Andy Van, because my first name and employment as a van driver were the only details they needed.
Yep, you've heard that name before.
Yes, Andy Van. Yeah, that was how everybody knew him.
Andy Van is in fact an SDS undercover cop, Detective Inspector Andy Coles. And after his tour of duty, 4 years with animal rights groups, he's tasked with writing a guide to the art of spying. And that's what Martin and I are holding, the Tradecraft Manual. It's full of character. There's a certain flair to Andy's writing, shall we say, and there are dozens of exclamation marks scattered throughout. To go with its tone, it's also got its own jargon, which reflects the squad's language. The officers call themselves the Hairies, most likely because they grow long hair and beards for their disguise. And anything related to their fake life is their duff, while the new area they live is bandit country. And the targets, or left-wing activists? Well, they're the Wearies.
Once launched, the officer must survive on his or her wits until feeling entirely comfortable in the role. From time to time, problems will arise which will affect your duff or real life, the majority of which will be discussed below. Another important consideration is where your workplace is in relation to your duff and real home. An employer working in the midst of your bandit country may well get fed up with occasional visits by your wearies or their telephone calls. If the workplace is convenient for them, be assured they will come around.
When I first read the manual, I wasn't sure what weary meant, so I thought I'd ask a few people. The first person I call is Neil Woods, a former undercover cop who used to work for the drug squad. He's left the police now.
Hi, Cara.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing?
All right. How are you doing?
There's another part of the Tradecraft Manual, which is just a small detail, but no one we've spoken to so far knows the answer. In it, they describe the activist targets as wearies. Do you know why that is?
Activist targets?
Well, like the people that they were spying on.
Wearies. Can you spell
yeah.
it?
Wearies.
No, that's not a phrase I know, actually. Wearies. Wearies. No, I don't know where that comes from. It might have been formed from an acronym, maybe.
Do you think it... Does it sound like a sort of official police word to you, or do you think it's a sort of derogatory term for a left-wing activist?
It'll be an internal colloquial phrase with a practical application, but it probably also has its origins in something derogatory.
I try someone more official to see if they have a better idea.
There's a police word, well, in the Met, there is a police word.
That's David Tucker again, from the College of Policing.
That refers to calls that just take an awful long time to deal with but aren't really very important, and they're referred to as being weary. It was a weary call. Yeah, yeah. What it really means is it makes me weary. That term had a certain resonance when I saw it, yeah.
And Detective Inspector Andy Coles warns the undercovers about that weariness too.
It may seem odd to consider the possibility of facing boredom in this sort of work, but boredom is as much part of the experience as the exciting bits. You should always be prepared for the tedium of waiting for a weary to knock on your door, sitting outside a police station for 12 hours until your last comrade is released, or taking part in a week of mind-numbing discussions on political theory.
A lot of what we're going to hear are insights into the culture of this area of elite policing, or at least as it was in the 90s and early noughties. There have been changes since, which we'll get into later in the series. But as a warning, some of it's shocking. Let's start with recruitment. Who gets to become an undercover agent for the police?
I was a police officer for 32 years, mainly in London, but I did work for a central unit, mainly to do with counter-terrorism, and we don't say whether we were or were not undercover police officers. It's one of those, you don't confirm or deny it.
Mm. We'll take from that what we will then.
Yeah.
That's a common refrain you hear from the police, can neither confirm nor deny. OK, so David may or may not have been an undercover cop himself. But today he heads up the department that trains them.
You have to be unbelievably quick-witted to, you know, to spot when there's danger, to understand what that is, to be able to, you know, to live your new identity all the time. And you have to be incredibly non-judgmental, which is, again, you know, something completely alien to policing.
And that's not the only thing that's alien about this area.
Officers who are able to do undercover work are a particular type of individual. It's very difficult to put your finger on it, but, you know, they have to be utterly trustworthy. But they also have to be able to, conversely, be able to live a lie.
So they've got to be pretty unique to fit the bill. And superiors are always on the lookout for new talent.
You would be spotted as somebody who could do this, and you would be sort of brought into it in a slow, gentle way.
Yep, recording.
That's exactly what happens to Neil Woods.
So I used to infiltrate drug dealing gangs around the UK.
He was undercover for 13 years.
I was aware of what they were doing in the 1990s because there was an attempt to recruit me into that kind of work.
The world of police spies is small and secretive, and the SDS operates under the radar. But it's made up of detectives who come from other areas of the police, so they all know one another.
And it's a real different clique.
You're in that club.
You're connected.
You're so good at it.
You have a high opinion of yourself.
Go get 'em.
Gung-ho.
They tend to have been people, certainly in the 1990s, who had been on the regional and then national crime squad. So there were highly qualified detectives who've worked with other detectives and networked through the crime squad. So they all knew each other. And it's a real old boys' club. And I mean old boys club because I don't think I ever met one of those detectives who wasn't male and of a certain type as well.
It's one of these officers in the old boys club who approaches Neil and says,
"Look, Woody, we really want you to do this course." It was a level one undercover work, which was a sort of more detailed and sophisticated type that I was doing. So much more long-term infiltration. And he explained to me it was over concerns of the influence of political groups. And in particular, what he wanted me to be a part of is the infiltration of animal rights groups. And he explained to me, because this is a growth problem and there isn't sufficient talent within the police who can blend in with those type of people. Anyway, he came back a couple of weeks later and tried again. And then a third time, a different detective sergeant came to me and very solemnly got me in an office, sat me down in the chair and said, "Woodsy, look, we really, really need you to do this work because you understand all that hippie shit.
Now, officers might be handpicked for this work, but there's still an intense interview and training process. This is level one deep cover, after all. Neil doesn't actually get that far, though, and we'll hear why later. But he does have a good understanding of how it works.
A colleague of mine, who is a very successful undercover cop for drugs, he did the course. He said, "Yeah, I'm up for that. I'll do that."
And it's 2 weeks long, and then there's 5 days of role play. On the first day of training, the new recruits are in the classroom. And one by one, they tell each other a bit about themselves. And Neil's friend introduces himself.
He told him about himself, said he was a football fan. He says, "The person I admire is Paul Weller." I said, "Right, thank you."
The friend hasn't quite understood that he's meant to be in character from the start. In turn, the other officers have a go, and they say things like,
"The person I admire most is the man who stood in front of the tank
on Tiananmen Square. And of course, every person who went round the class had some suitable political hero. It was clear that my colleague hadn't really grasped what he was there for, I think.
That's because one of the main obstacles these cops will face is convincing passionate left-wing activists that they care about the cause.
So it's about learning about the politics and doing the homework.
The main thing that any budding SDS officer needs to prove is that they can become a protester. In the second week of training, they're told to go to a supermarket and poison some fruit. It's their first political act.
Maybe the fruit was from a particular country, or maybe it was Israeli fruit. I don't know what it was, but he was told to go and do this.
Neil's friend is completely baffled by this task.
He explained to me later, he says, mate, I think that's where I failed the course, because I just couldn't get my head round what I was going to do. You know, what do I do? Am I meant to do this? Am I meant to pretend to do it? Am I meant to go and do it with someone else? What am I meant to do? But it was never explained to him. They were given a task with very broad parameters, and the people who passed the course were the ones who worked their way through it.
Only the very best get accepted into the SDS. And once they do, it's time for them to prepare to go undercover, to give up their entire life and create a new one. More on that after this short break.
Hi, my name's Theodora Laloudis. I'm the podcast editor at The Telegraph, which really means I spend a lot of time talking to myself in padded studios and with large headphones on, listening to hours and hours of audio. But it also means that I get to commission podcasts like this one and to give a powerful platform to those people whose stories need to be told, just like the amazing women you're hearing from on Bed of Lies. But doing justice to important stories, as I hope we've done on this podcast, takes time and it takes a skilled team. And that's where our subscribers come in. Without their contribution, we wouldn't have been able to make this show. So if you'd like to support what we're doing and to get unlimited access to the huge range of quality journalism on politics, sport, business, culture and much, much more, head to telegraph.co.uk/liespodcast, where you can get your first 30 days access to The Telegraph online completely free. And after that, it's just £2 a week. That's telegraph.co.uk/liespodcast, or click on the link in the show notes to this episode.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
New recruits into the SDS will be raring to go, to get out there. But they can't rush this kind of work. And if they're found out, the whole operation will be blown. So they need to learn how to live undercover for 4 years. And it's going to take months of preparation. But as Detective Inspector Andy Coles says,
the major reason why it takes at least 3 months or longer to graduate from the back office to the field is the time it takes for your appearance to change.
They're going to need to blend in with the people they're spying on, to look just like a weary, so that they'll be accepted straight away.
The best way of achieving this is to change your appearance radically.
glasses.
For men, the addition of a beard and glasses to a normally clean-shaven face.
Had a beard and he had an earring.
An earring?
In one ear.
And radically different haircut.
He had long hair.
Long hair and tattoos and piercings.
And he had a little scraggy ponytail and a mullet.
You should try to wear clothes which are similar in style to each other but different from your normal garb.
Brush cotton.
For example, always wear bold checked shirts and jeans.
Lumberjack shirts.
Big sloppy jumpers.
Army greens.
A distinctive coat or hat.
He always wore like a beanie, hats.
Or whatever least resembles your own tastes.
He looked kind of like one of us.
While their appearance is changing, they'll have time to develop their new identity. They can opt for the blockbuster movie option and receive a manila file containing everything they need to know about their cover. Or they can do the legwork themselves and come up with a name and backstory.
By tradition, the aspiring SDS officer's first major task on joining the back office was to spend hours and hours at St. Catherine's House, leafing through death registers in search of a name he could call his own.
That's the old public records office at Somerset House in London.
Avoid infant deaths or people aged over 16. The first are easy to spot, and the second will have records in the DSS, the Department for Social Security, which could be checked by the wearies.
Let's translate that. Recruits pick their cover name by looking at death certificates for children, or as they call them, ex-persons. What they're looking for is an older child whose death was unspectacular and therefore not reported in newspapers. And the code name for this part of the mission? It's the Jackal Run, after the novel by Frederick Forsyth.
The Day of the Jackal explained how to acquire the name of a dead person.
Most officers go for someone with the same first name as their own, so that they avoid any mishaps in the field. And when they've found the right name, they need to check one more thing. Does the dead child have any family they could come across?
Further research would follow to establish the respiratory status of the dead person's family, if any, and if they were still breathing, where they were living. If all was suitably obscure and there was little chance of the SDS officer, or more importantly, one of the wearies, running into the dead person's parents, siblings, etc., the SDS officer would assume squatter's rights over the unfortunate's identity for the next 4 years.
But there are potholes in this path. And in fact, one undercover's already been caught out.
All well and good, but we are all familiar with the story of an SDS officer being confronted with his own death certificate.
Andy's referring to an officer called Richard Clark, who had a relationship with at least two women. An editor's note has been added to the manual to say this practice has been discontinued.
It follows that an imaginary identity must now be made up by the field officer.
And how to do that? Well, those details are blacked out. They've been redacted. But there is a handy appendix at the back with a list of the most common British names. But they need more than that. They need to create a whole new character, a backstory.
In most of the groups we cover, there is a high level of paranoia and suspicion, so you will eventually have to flesh out the bones of your life.
His dad was killed by a drunken driver.
He was estranged from this
and
son.
And he had a terrible relationship with his mother.
There aren't many details on this, but Andy says they need to be able to go away for periods of time and stop the activists from asking too many questions.
No one knew the name or home address of the fictitious uncle I used as an excuse to get away from the occasional weekend demos.
And there was an uncle that he had who he used to visit and work with. For some reason, I wasn't able to meet this uncle.
And work's another good excuse for long absences. But new recruits have to make sure that if they say they do a practical job, they can back it up.
If you allude to a particular skill, such as plumbing, carpentry or so on, be prepared to be asked to repair a washing machine or rehang a sticking door.
You change people's locks on their houses.
And make sure you have tools and the knowledge to do the job.
Yeah, he had a bag of tools and he put our kitchen in.
The best thing an undercover can do is to come across as someone who isn't very comfortable talking about themselves.
What should happen is that little facts about yourself will be revealed slowly to your circle of activists, and over time, a mutual trust will be built up.
And then I remember him kind of half-jokingly once saying, you know, I can't really tell you all about my career as a drug smuggler, and laughing it off.
But how can you create a really convincing persona? Not only are these organisations often suspicious of newcomers, but the cops also need to be able to sustain the act for years, to live the role.
The bigger your legend, the bigger your falsehood, the harder it is to maintain in terms of memory and how you develop yourself.
That's Neil Woods again, the former undercover cop.
When I was taught by some very qualified long-term level one undercovers, one of them used to make the point that as an undercover cop, you can't be an actor. You have to just be a different version of yourself. And that doesn't really make much sense until it's explained in the way that an actor can do a role on the stage and be a different person for 2 hours on a stage or for an hour in a scene in a film. But to live that all the time, you can't pretend to be someone completely different, because if you do, you're more likely to be found out, because to maintain a complete deception is much harder than just having a slight shifted version of yourself.
So they've grown long beards, they've got ear piercings and Don Check shirts, they've got a new name and a backstory. They're ready to go in the field to start their tour of duty.
Now you've become a member or supporter of your target organisation, you're on your own. You will be living on your wits with very little technical support or backup.
But the Met isn't going to send spies into the field completely alone. Oh no. They'll each have a cover officer or handler who's available 24/7 for any emergencies, and they'll speak to them every day. They'll also have a large budget. Now, I'm talking as much as £200,000 in expenses, according to one former officer, and not to mention some vital equipment.
You will have a new identity, including driving licence, passport. Your most important asset will be your vehicle.
He would drive people to demonstrations.
Generous with offering lifts.
Wanted to be helpful.
That's what made him such an indispensable member of that group.
And there's another way the van will help.
The major bonus of being the driver is a clear opportunity to avoid arrest. The driver is always needed to get people home after a demo or action, and there is no shame in keeping away from trouble for that reason.
Now, that bit of advice speaks to the golden rule of undercover policing. These officers are going to be immersed in the action, a key member of their groups. And that brings us to what they'll actually be doing out there. Their job is to monitor everything the wearies get up to, the protests they plan, discussions they have, and even the parties they go to. And then they'll feed all the intelligence back to the handler. They could find themselves hanging out with people who plan to commit minor crimes, and they need to know how to deal with it. But there's one rule they must always follow.
It was the number one instruction for undercover officers, is that you must not act as an agent provocateur.
Ex-undercover cop Neil Woods.
You must not incite or procure someone to commit an offence that they wouldn't have committed.
The instruction Neil's referring to is laid out in the Tradecraft Manual.
At no time can you instigate, counsel or procure others to commit a crime.
But it's immediately followed by a caveat that completely undermines it.
The above sentiments are laudable, but the boundary between right and wrong in the SDS arena is never as clear-cut as the provisions of...
The difference between these two units with the political spying is that they were never intended to gather evidence or go to court, ever. They were merely spying, which, to my mind, is not policing. This is the work of MI5.
David Tucker from the College of Policing has a different take on this.
The intention was for those units to make a legal and proper contribution to policing so that the illegal activities of the groups they were looking at could be confronted and dealt with. Clearly what happened is that some people went off script.
And what that can mean out in the field is these loose boundaries, well, they result in a bit of rule bending.
An undercover cop you're a problem solver. You work things out, and you know, most of us will be quite dynamic and good at solving problems and quite good at organising things as well. That you put a police officer who's used to seeing a problem, listing the solutions and doing it, you put that amongst a group of people who will really like to sit down and talk about it for a few days, then you know, you've got a personality clash going on here. And, you know, a police officer wants to get moving and get things to report. So he gets him up. He's the natural organiser. He becomes the natural leader of a group. But without the restraints of agent provocateur, because then they never intended to be accountable, then they can do that, can't they?
Neil never gets anywhere near to this stage, though, because he has a fundamental disagreement with the guy from the SDS, the one who first approaches him.
My question to him was, who's the bad guy? Who am I chasing here?
At the time he's approached, Neil's spying on people who are suspected of kidnap and murder. His job's to find enough evidence to put them in jail. But that's not the case with this work that's being offered to him with the SDS. And Neil says to another senior officer...
So basically, you want me to spy on people who want to go and rescue beagles, is what you're saying to me. And so I said, no, thank you. I wasn't interested. This is not just about rescuing beagles, he said. This is about the state of the economy. If the companies, the international companies that have investment in the UK, have interests in the UK, that use animal testing, if those companies find the UK too hostile and they leave the UK, this will have such a dramatic impact on our economy that the GDP will drop by 5%. And this will cause a depression. And can you imagine the public order problems following such a dramatic depression? But the thing that came to my mind is, so you want me to spy on people for the sake of shareholder dividends?
Now to the real bread and butter of undercover work, forming relationships. They've got to befriend activists and worm their way into the middle of social circles. No matter how well trained they are, their success relies on people believing them. And a key technique is called mirroring.
Say we want to meet someone and we date people and we're trying to find a partner. One of the first things you'll probably connect with is a shared interest of a particular group or a particular genre of music. It's a key part of how things happen.
I like the fact he played guitar.
We seem to have similar tastes in music.
Vegan, we shared ideals.
Similar outlooks in life.
That's the beginnings of your common ground, isn't it? Before you move on to the more delicate things like sort of political persuasion and whether you believe in God or not or something like that. And I don't think you need much training to know those things, really. You just need to have the green light to do it to somebody. They would have chosen people they knew they could manipulate. I mean, if I was to try and put myself in their shoes, it would be somebody who was full of life, friendly, extrovert, connected to lots of people. It would be the lively, friendly person who might, you know, find a relationship a joyous thing.
That word, relationship. What Neil's talking about here isn't friendship. He's talking about romance, falling in love, sex. The chances are these cops might come across a situation where someone's flirting with them, a weary they're getting to know pretty well. Now, this is an area that's fraught with difficulty.
The thorny issue of romantic entanglements during a tour is the cause of much soul-searching and concern. In the past...
And they have to make up their own mind on how to proceed. But remember, it could risk their cover being blown. And so if they have no other choice but to become involved with someone, just make sure it's fleeting and disastrous.
But to become involved with a weary, should try to have fleeting, disastrous relationships. One cannot be involved with a weary in a relationship for any period of time without risking serious consequences.
I just find it hard to imagine how those cops could really do that, because you know what you're doing. You know, when you're manipulating someone like that, you know what you're doing.
Neil's experienced this firsthand when he's out in the field for the drug squad. He's in the northeast of England getting to know an amphetamine dealer, and he befriends the guy's girlfriend.
She was clearly interested in me and flirted uncomfortably with me. And when I reported this back to my handler and the detective who was running the operation, their approach was, well, go for it, lad. Go on. With a sort of very misogynistic, go on, my son, you know, go for it. And that was the sort of natural approach.
But this woman's vulnerable. She's been a victim of domestic abuse, and Neil's told his handler that.
And this horrified me, the idea that I would use this position and deceive someone into a relationship. It just absolutely horrified me.
But as they're making these connections, infiltrating people's lives, making friends, starting relationships, the undercover cops are told to never lose sight of the end point. And pretty early in their deployment, they need to start thinking about their exit strategy. They've got 4 years and counting from the moment they enter the field. So there comes a time, about 2 years in, that it's a good idea to test the waters for their departure.
As one's tour passes the halfway stage, it's useful to play the disillusioned activist to see how your wearies react.
If the wearies look like they might try and talk the officer into staying, then they might want to lay the groundwork for a different kind of exit.
One could pretend to have personal difficulties that cause you to leave the political arena. You'll have to think through the circumstances where such an approach could be effective.
And so our author Andy starts to have problems with his mental health.
After a short period of depression, I bounce back into activism with renewed vigour, but that short period of disillusionment made a move abroad to work easier to justify when I was preparing to leave the field for good.
It appeared like he was having a breakdown.
Very unstable.
He was depressed and he was tired.
Spinning a bit more out of control.
But there's one other piece of advice that's truly shocking. Something that stands out when you look at it now.
When you settle down into a work routine, you will find a few hours during the day are free to spend at home with your family.
Their family.
There is no doubt that partners find your unavailability the most difficult part of your tour. So make every effort to spend time together on a regular basis. The Duff lifestyle may force you to spend periods of intense activity away from home. So make allowances for these periods.
It can be tough for officers to split their lives in two like this.
Dangers of Stockholm Syndrome.
David Tucker again.
You know, danger of becoming part of the group, but also the disconnect between the job you're doing and who you are becomes very, very difficult, becomes very stressful.
And so the solution to avoid Stockholm Syndrome?
Did they have to have a wife, a family back home in order to be an officer? Was that a criteria to join one of these units?
I don't know the answer to that.
But there is someone who might have an answer to that. The only SDS cop to have turned whistleblower, Peter Francis. So I call up Neil Woods, who's in close contact with Francis, and I ask him, did SDS undercover officers have to be married?
I've spoken with Peter Francis about this, and he's explained to me that they did have a rule that all operatives had to be married, so that they had something to leave the deployment for, so that they wouldn't go native.
Next time on Bed of Lies.
When he was getting up at 6:30 every morning, he was actually going to his real family, and he left there to be back at the end of the day with me.
Bed of Lies is written by me, Cara McGugan, and produced by Sarah Peters at Tuning Fork Productions. The executive producer is Theodora Laloudis, and sound designs by Peregrine Andrews. To stay on top of who's who in our story, to see exclusive pictures of the men involved, and to look inside my reporter's notebook, go to telegraph.co.uk/bed of lies.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.